The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to We the People Radio. For our second hour, that's going to go as fast as the first hour, unfortunately.
Yes, so it did. It flew by.
Listen quickly. You're joining Aaron.
And Bill.
And Bob.
We're here every Sunday from noon to 2 on the West Coast, and this show re-airs on the East Coast from 1 to 3 in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore at WNJC 1360 AM. They get all that right?
Yeah, very good.
On the Conservative Commandos Network, and 1 to 3 Mondays. So anyway, we'd love to hear your comments if you have any ideas for shows or as topics or guests, people you've heard or read books about, think it'd be interesting, and stuff that doesn't get very much airtime. We are that great spot for them. So join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Everything is on there. Tons of shows, 5 years worth of archives, and we usually have a commercial-free archive posted by later in the afternoon on Sunday. So if it's a time problem for you, you can get each hour down to about 40 minutes. And that is all. That is all the news that's fit to print. Okay, back to Mr. Wood. All right, Pat. On the technocracy thing, I remember reading in your book that what blew up the technocracy movement in the 30s, part of it, one piece of it, was that they had uniforms.
Yes, they had a paramilitary look.
I always thought that was like a bridge too far, huh?
Yeah, like a double-breasted suit, gray. They all dressed alike. They had a dark blue necktie. They had the men had broad brim hats, nice dress suit type hats, and they all wore a little insignia. The corporate insignia was a monad symbol.
What is that?
And the women had a very similar outfit. Of course, it was a skirt and a a dress, female oriented, I guess you'd say, but it was still double breasted. And it was a very striking look when you saw them all together. They even went so far as to contact Ford and General Motors and have them offer a technocracy gray paint for cars.
Wow.
Join the team. It's off a technocracy gray car. And not only would the car be gray, but the hubcaps were painted kind of an orange, red color. It's very striking. This was technocracy.
Wow.
And they had this, so they had this paramilitary look. That didn't fly too well, so it looked a lot like the SS. And so when Nazi Germany really got rolling, especially when the U.S. got in the war, it's like, hey man, this looks too much like who we're fighting over there. And what's really kind of a telltale on that is in Canada actually outlawed technocracy for a period of 2 years.
Really?
Yes, they did.
And how would you do that?
They called them a subversive organization and shut them down.
Oh, you mean they outlawed it? Like you couldn't meet? You were considered a bad guy?
That's right.
Oh, not
That's
just
right.
the technology part of the technocracy, just the...
No, they felt there was too close of a look and tie and everything else to the Germans. And they said, you're not going to do this here. You're not going to... No more technocracy.
Wow.
They let them... They put them back into existence after a couple of years and... this wasn't lost on Americans either, I'll tell you. They kind of got it, and they kind of got the idea also that technocracy was really a crackpot scheme. It promised utopia, but it couldn't deliver.
Sure.
It had no basis for delivering.
Just like now, with their whole sustainable development, we're all going to live in a little rabbit hutch
organization-wise, how big did they get?
Well, there was over 500,000 card-carrying technocrats in North America at the height of the movement.
Holy cow.
And there was a lot more that were following the movement that weren't card-carrying technocrats. It was a membership organization when I say card-carrying.
Sure.
That's how they survived. You had to pay a fee, whatever it was, $5 or something, to become a member. And that's how they were supported. They got no institutional money from anybody back then.
Well,
but they were out there. It was a very popular movement. California, Oregon, and Washington were really overrated with technocracy. Like, there was a bunch of them there. And up into British Columbia, but really all the way across America and Europe, or America and Canada, there was just tons of technocrats.
Wow. And yeah. And these folks then, how did when you did all the digging with Mr. Sutton on the Trilateral Commission, how did, were any of those people the same people, or were they just an outgrowth of the same idea? What's the, can you, is there a direct connection there?
Well, there is, and you could call modern-day technocracy neo-technocracy if you wanted to, just kind of to indicate there's a new flavor to it.
Okay.
Which there is. It's slightly different, but not much. But Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. Sutton and I had read that book and sliced it, diced it 6 ways Sunday. We knew it quite well. And that was really the book that got he and Rockefeller together. We knew that, too. And we knew that the Trilateral Commission's New International Economic Order was a product of that thinking that Brzezinski brought to the table. We just didn't know about historic technocracy at the time. But it just so happens that original technocracy in 1932 was housed at Columbia University in New York City. They occupied the lower basement, or the basement of Hamilton Hall, well, half of the basement at Hamilton Hall, for a period of about a year before they got booted. And they did get booted. The president of Columbia realized that the promoter, the number one promoter of technocracy, was a fraud, didn't even have an engineering degree, and that doesn't fly well at a place like Columbia. So they kicked him out, and they went out, the two co-founders went out and started a corporation in New York City, and that's how Technocracy Comma Incorporated got started.
Okay.
But it started out at Columbia University, and even though they got booted, the scientists and engineers at Columbia never recanted technocracy. They just went into hiding. They knew they better shut their mouth and just take care of their own departments and teach. You know, just like, don't want to hear technocracy anymore. Okay, we won't talk about it. But we want to keep our jobs. You know, a lot of these people were tenured scientists and engineers. And so they just kind of, you know, went along with the program and shut up. But oddly enough, we find Zbigniew Brzezinski some 20 plus years later at Columbia University when he writes this book. He was a relatively young professor of political science at Columbia University when he wrote Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. So there's a very direct connection through Columbia University, because those kinds of philosophies and movements don't die within academia. They continue to be discussed as part of the big melting pool of ideas. So there's no doubt that the science and technocrats and stuff at Columbia continue to discuss it in the cafeteria and, you know, at meetings, stuff like that.
Yeah, and I guess it's okay if they want to talk about alternative systems.
How great,
you know,
it would be if they ran
systems.
The world.
But it becomes the topic, and it becomes the main topic of what they talk about anymore.
Yes. And I will say that technocracy, as I said before, did not have an institutional support back in its day, in the 30s. And in that sense, Brzezinski and Rockefeller and that whole crowd of global elitists at the time, they really did hijack or plagiarize, if you will, the entire technocracy movement from the 1930s. And technocrats don't like to hear that today. I've talked to some people who actually still are members of Technocracy Comma Incorporated. And I say, well, does it upset you that your whole thing has been hijacked by these people and that they're using it for their own, you know, visions of global domination? And, oh, that's not true. Whatever. I mean, they just don't have a clue of what's going on around them. But, the movement as a whole was adopted by Rockefeller when he realized that he could use it for complete global domination. That was the deal. I just am absolutely certain that's what clicked in his mind when he and Brzezinski got together in those early days. He said, this is it. This is where this is going. We want to be a part of this. We're going to use it, manipulate it to control all the resources of the world, because that's what technocrats wanted to do. They wanted to take all the resources of every community, every state, every district away from the people and manage those resources for the good of the people and let the people just have as much as they need.
That they decide that we need, actually.
That's right. How much they decide how much you need, and you will have that much. That was going to produce the maximum efficient society. Remember, as we talked about, technocracy being the science of social engineering. And so that would be the most efficient use of everything would be if we just control it and we just kind of tell people what's out there and how much of it they can buy. And otherwise, you don't have any need for private property. We'll take care of you. We'll make sure everything is out there. You'll have plenty of leisure time to go play and, you know, do whatever you want to do. Listen to music or read a good book or whatever.
Watch TV,
you
know, like the song Last Hour.
Yes.
Get all their information from the networks.
Yep. We'll show you what to think, and we'll explain that to you. So I guess we better thank our advertisers, since we still have some out here in the free world. We're going to come back with Patrick Wood. We're talking about technocracy and all the things surrounding it. If you've missed his previous shows, go to the website and look. You've probably got about 4 hours of potential listening at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Yes, and we know where that man will be living.
Yes.
Pat, we were looking on the website, on your website, actually, at your last newsletter, and we would be remiss not to bring up the Agenda 20, your article, Agenda 21 for Cities, 300 square foot condos for $275,000.
What a steal. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, this is like, you look at this thing and you go, no.
No, don't put me in there.
No, how could this happen?
It's got everything you need, though, and no room for all that stuff you don't really need. And they've
already it more likely resembles kind of a fancy jail cell.
It does.
You know, that's actually kind of true, because you for people that aren't looking at this, you should go to the website and look at it. But anyway, we the people. radio.us, and you just look down on the newsletter that I've attached, and it's about the 300 square foot condos, and there's a lovely picture there. It's a little skinny place with a loft, but when you think of a loft, like there's room up there. No. This is basically just a thing that sticks out from the wall that is big enough to hold a bed. So you
crawl.
Yeah, you crawl up there like you're 8 years old and sleep in your little bunk bed, and when you come down the stairs, don't hurry because you'll fall in your sink. You have a sink and a counter. It looks like it's about like you couldn't lay on it. It's probably 4 feet long, and you have a desk with a chair and a really really big TV.
Little stovetop and a little oven, and that's about all you really need.
Yeah, a little Davenport and an itty bitty little coffee table with little tiny metal legs. Do you go to the bathroom in the kitchen, or is there a bathroom we just can't see?
You know, I think there's a bathroom in there somewhere. I'm looking at the picture myself.
I was figuring the dishwasher doubled as a toilet or something.
I know. Yeah, the sink doubles. I mean, uh huh.
Yeah, are people
look out for the disposal?
Yeah.
But you know, they've been making this type of a living arrangement in Japan for a long time, because property is such a high premium there that they've had little almost like that Seinfeld episode where he was stacking the little Japanese people in the drawers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That dresser.
The old dresser drawers. Yeah, yeah. But this is a little bit of what's to come, it looks like.
Yeah, one of the most popular types of modular housing right now is made out of 40-foot shipping containers.
Hmm.
Of course, they're a little bigger, 40 foot by, what, 10 feet or something? That's 400 feet. That's actually quite a bit more than this one here.
That's moving up, yeah.
Yeah, when you're living in 300 square feet, 100 more feet is a really lot.
That's a big deal.
Big deal. Now, somebody asked me on this bed, how do you make that bed anyway? Well, I don't know. I don't think you can make that bed hardly, except you crawl up on your hands and knees.
Yeah.
And somehow try and tuck the stuff in the side and make it look halfway decent.
Well, because you can't stand up and make that bed. I mean, you got to be on your hands and knees because you're almost up against the ceiling.
And where's all your storage anyway? You know, I mean, you got to have a closet. You got to have some other stuff.
Oh,
whatever.
Yeah. Where is that?
You'd end up living like in a pigsty, in my estimation.
Well, you'd probably just have,
have stuff everywhere.
Two Greenpeace T-shirts and... And I don't know, all the rage now for the 20-something men seems to be these capri pants. It's so scary.
Yeah.
We saw some of those the other night. It's like, what?
But, you know, if you look at this, if you live someplace that has no storage, which means you're not going to buy a bunch of stuff and have it sitting around your house like a lot of people do now, what's that going to do to our economy? I mean, for all these stores that sell all the knick-knack, paddywhack stuff, I mean, you're just they're going to go out of business because there's no place to store.
It's going to kill them.
Yeah.
You're right. But see, this plays into the whole Agenda 20, the sustainable consumption mantra.
Right.
Because you're not going to be able to buy anything. You're right. Where are you going to put it?
Yeah.
You're not going to buy a big gas-guzzling boat or, you live in a thing like this, you're probably not even going to have a car.
Well, in here, you can't even, if you bought a lamp, you couldn't fit it. Yeah, you couldn't put a blender, a microwave, a coffee pot, a lamp. You know, you look at just basic things that are in somebody's.
You just don't buy any of that stuff anymore.
There's not even room for plants.
But this is what they want to do, a la Agenda 21 and 2030 Agenda. This is the whole business, 21 and 2030 Agenda. This is the whole business of sustainable consumption. They want you to cut back on everything you use. And that's the only way to reduce your carbon footprint. Now, I guarantee you, a single guy or woman living in an apartment like this, 300 plus feet, is going to have a low carbon footprint, according to them.
Mm-hmm.
This is the goal. To minimize the carbon footprint of every human on Earth. That's why one reason they want to herd everybody into cities and make them live in stuff like this. High density, high density, complete high density. This redefines high density, obviously. But, high density dwelling like this is what they're designing cities for today.
At the end of the day, you can't have a kid.
Not
place. Where are you going to put them? You need a coffee table that converts into a little stowaway bed there.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening.
I can't put my finger on it right this second, but I actually saw a statement one time reading some apologist for sustainable development in relation to these small little living quarters. And the guy said, well, why would you need any more space?
Yeah, why?
Yeah. What would you be wasting that for?
Why would you need any more? Isn't anything more than this wasteful?
You know, it's interesting because when people look at it and think, "Well, how are they going to convince everyone of this?" Well, I have a great current example. In California, if you look at 100% of the water, well, first of all, let's start with they want households to cut back 30% of their water use. So everyone's, yards are dead. I don't know what they're doing with their showering. I've heard some creative alternatives. You're not supposed to wash your dishes or flush your toilet and all that jazz. But so you look at that. They want to cut back household water use by 30%. And you constantly hear that agriculture uses 80% of the water. Well, the actual real numbers in California, 100% of the water, if you look at the real 100% of the water, 50% goes to fish. So you kiss off 50%, it's going down the river. 40% goes to agricultural and 10% goes to houses. But see, if you don't count the 50 that goes to fish and the rest of it is considered 100%, if you lie about it, if you basically cheat the statistics, you're looking at 80%. You know, you just double that ag number. But to get back to reality, 10% is households. So if we're cutting back 30%, 30% water cutback, they're saving in reality 3%.
Yeah, because they're cutting back 30% of the 10.
Of 10%, yeah. Which is the real number. So they're cutting back 3% of the state's total water use. How stupid is that?
And if you don't comply,
like the fish would notice 3%.
They'll send you a little added surprise on your water bill
Ratted Bill out. Bill was using water at the wrong time. We got a letter that said exactly what time he was using it.
And this is my final warning. If I get caught using water during the day again on the wrong watering day.
Yeah, because you've affected that 3% savings statewide.
That's right.
Is that just crazy? But see, that's the thing. They've got everybody convinced that this really has meaning. I'm sorry. You could waste 3% of the state's water. No one will notice. And if that's the case, if we can give 50% of our water away to fish, but just not tell anyone about it, you can get people to do all this, jump through all these hoops. So, I don't know, talking them into living in 250 square feet or 300 square feet, maybe they guys get the guys who do California water policy to sell it.
Well, you know, they built a big rabbit hutch complex down in Walnut Creek that had all the living spaces upstairs. I think it was like three stories, four stories.
Yeah, and stores down below, the mixed-use housing.
Yeah, and they first had a hard time filling them because nobody really wanted to live, next to BART and downtown where there's
which
no place to park a car.
Bay Area Rapid Transit for people who don't live
there. And there were no – I think there was a Starbucks in all of the stores downstairs. Nobody moved into those business units. So, I mean, I'm just wondering how successful – are these complexes that they're building in some of these cities? I think in New York they're probably a little more successful just because of the density. But I think a lot of these towns, people have a choice of living there or living in a real house. They're not doing it. So for all they're saying about how successful this is, I'd like to see the real numbers.
Yeah, the only people going into these are young people. Who can't afford anything else so far.
Yeah, and I was reading, the reason for that is the rental market today is getting so expensive that young people can't save money to buy a house, and so they're forced into a rental situation or one of these little rabbit hutches, and that's about as good as it's going to get until something changes.
That's right. You know, if you went to college and you stayed in a dorm,
that's
it's really no different than staying in a dorm room.
No, this
but
would actually be kind of palatial.
Life?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess they expect them to do, because you could never socialize at your own house. There's nowhere to put them.
No, you have to go
to
a common area.
No, they have these common areas and stuff, supposedly, where you can go and recreate and have a lounge and a TV and commingle, with the other people in the community.
Yeah.
Hopefully you like your neighbors.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you imagine?
If you got a bad neighbor, that kind of ruins the
one bad guy.
The whole common area, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, it's like communes. You know, communes failed because nobody wanted to live in them because eventually they all made each other mad and decided they wanted to wear clothes and, eat meat or whatever. I don't know what broke up the deal, but my guess would be all that big love fest didn't really work out.
All that sharing.
All the sharing. Sharing sucks. Bob, do we have to take another break? Okay, we're actually on time today. We're going to take another quick break. Okay, when we come back, Pat, I wanted to look at your article about smart cities could signal the end of democracy. Because people think these smart cities are a great idea. Not. And we're going to explain why. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give me land, lots of land under starry skies above.
I'm not a condo.
Don't
fence me
in. Let me ride through the wide open
nice,
country
Bob.
That I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in, just turn me loose.
Get your ticket to that wheel in space while there's time. The fix is in. You'll be a witness to that game of chance in the sky. You know we've got to win. Here at home we'll play in the city. I would buy the sun.
Power buttons.
Big weather for a streamlined world. There'll be spandex jackets.
Okay, everybody put your hands in the air and sway.
There you go. Spandex jackets for everyone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the amount of spandex I've seen at the grocery store over the last 10 years is last me a lifetime.
I'm kind of over spandex.
I'm way over spandex. So, okay, in this Smart Cities article, Mr. Wood, my favorite paragraph, such utopian urban visions help us drive the smart city rhetoric that has for the past decades or so been promulgated most energetically by big technology, engineering, and consulting companies. So I think for the people who think maybe we're like, you know, making this stuff up, see if this rings true. The movement is predicated on ubiquitous wireless broadband and the embedding of computerized sensors into the urban fabric so that bike racks, lamp posts, CCTV and traffic lights, as well as geeky home appliances such as internet fridges and remote-controlled heating systems, become part of the so-called Internet of Things, the global market for which is now estimated at $1.7 trillion. Better living through biochemistry gives us a way to dream of better living through data. Now, you know, anybody who doesn't see that we're sort of going this way is delusional, right?
Yeah, they are. And it's interesting, the people driving the whole smart city rhetoric, as they said, are the giant companies like Siemens, Honeywell, IBM, Accenture, which used to be Anderson Consulting, largest consulting company in the world. These companies have a lock on this, and what they're after is these, what they think is going to be a $2 trillion a year market by the year 2020. This is big bucks. And this has always been about money. But this is huge money. And if these people can engineer, and these are the technocrats, by the way, if they can engineer a city like this to get and convince people to live in, good luck with that. But if they can't, they're going to make so much money that it's just inconceivable of how much they're taking out in the process of this transformation. Just inconceivable.
Well, an interesting to me that the the cloth shopping bag people and the hemp clothing and the the organic bunch is typically your liberal set who loves this kind of stuff. Yes, we should all be riding bikes all the time, and we should all live in these little rabbit hutches, and meat is destruction, and we shouldn't even go into the forest because we're people and we don't belong there. All these things, and the funny part is, those same folks, to whatever degree they participate in that philosophy, universally hate big companies. Mm-hmm. And the funny part is, their whole thing is predicated on these giant companies enslaving them. And that's what they're helping them do.
Yeah. I went on a safari when I was 18 years old. My parents were hunters, and they took me on a safari to Africa. And I learned a lot of things over there. I was young, impressionable. It was a lot of fun. Saw a lot of neat animals and stuff. But when you go on a hunt, you have people have different functions. You might stand on the side of a clearing, maybe make a little blind for yourself with some branches, stuff like that. And you would stand there and you would wait for the other people called the beaters, who would go out into the bush and they would circle around maybe a mile out, and they'd come back through the area with noise making stuff like beating sticks together or maybe a pot and a pan, banging them together. And those beaters would drive the animals out through the open spot in front of the hunters so the hunters could take their license. And everybody had their role. And in the case of the whole sustainable development crowd, the reason I tell you the story is the United Nations has become the beaters for companies like Siemens, Honeywell, IBM, etc. to beat the business to them, you know, to panic people into going for this stuff. And then the people waiting on the side of the clearing to clean house on it are these companies. Routinely the same companies. General Electric, throw them in there. And they're making out for trillions and trillions of dollars as people run headlong and nilly-willy into sustainable development and things like smart cities. They're just sitting there picking off the game as the game comes running through the clearance, you know, through the meadow, because the beaters are out there beating the bush and driving people that way. It's a scam. I'll say it again. I said it at the beginning. It's an absolute scam of magnitude we've never seen in history.
And they've just got these guys hook, line, and sinker. You know, the solar Prius, you know, whatever, we're going to save the world because we're the ones who are ruining it, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're telling us, of course, that these new cities are completely efficient and, you know, much, much more forgiving on the economy or the ecology and stuff. And I've read a number of stories already that says that's just hogwash. That modern technology does not do any favors whatsoever for the environment. And I know that there's a lot of argument on that still, but you know, the evidence to me is just clear. It's no better than anything else man has ever done before, if not worse. It's just that, hey, when there's $2 trillion up for grabs, wouldn't you like to get a little piece of that? You don't need much. Well, how sure. about even just, you know, just 5%? Well, would be five percent would be $1 billion.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah,
you're kind of reminding me of the whole high speed rail in California. Man, there's vendors lining up for that just to get a little piece of it. I mean, I doubt if it'll ever be built, but there's going to be a lot of people lined up to get.
They're
going to
waste a lot of money not building it.
Might as well get a piece of it. It's nuts. Right. It's absolute nuts.
But we see companies like Siemens and Honeywell and IBM, we see them coming to drink at the trough every time you turn around with smart grid. Every time the United Nations goes burp, these are the companies that are there. They're always right there with their hand out. We can do that. We can do that. We can do that. Can't anybody see the scam, for Pete's sake? It's like, who's driving who here? Is the United Nations driving these people, or are these people driving the United Nations? And I can tell you the answer to that. They are driving the United Nations. It's the Siemens, the Honeywells, and the IBMs that are giving direction to the IBM sustainable development. It's their consultants, for Pete's sake, that are going in to these committees to testify and tell them how to do it. And so they go, oh, that's a good idea. Oh, smart cities. That's great, man. We like the sound of that.
Yeah, and that's about it, too. They do like the sound of it. So what do we do about it? I realize I left us less than 15 minutes to explore that side of it, so no pressure. Yeah. But should we get them uniforms again so that people can see them?
Yeah, really, that would be nice.
Hey, let's get uniforms, huh? Yeah, and then they blow up again. That'd be great. Repeat history.
I know. We can't defeat an enemy we don't know. That's one. We need to see who the enemy is. Truly, Americans do, because they don't see who the enemy is right now.
True.
But beyond that, I'll tell you, people, Americans need to get off their rather
butts.
Oversized rumps.
There you go.
Get off their couch. I want to be kind. I don't want to get you guys in trouble with the FCC or anything. They need to get up off their couch, get out of their house, and go down to their local, whatever it is, if they have a city council, a school board, a county board of supervisors, whatever they have, get down there and start mixing it up with these people, find out who the enemy, find out who the nutcakes are within that crowd, and drive them out of your community. Because this has trickled down to every community in America. You can imagine what the rest of the world is like right now. But for any community who doesn't clean up their own house, they're going to get what they deserve. That's all I can say. I don't mean to be any way punitive about this, but for any community that refuses to go out and clean up its own house with this stuff, they will get exactly what they deserve, and it's coming at them like a freight train.
Yeah, it is, because once they roll out, you know, the smart meters and all that kind of stuff, there's really no going back, unless, of course, they all catch on fire on the same day.
Very difficult. So if you don't like things, if you don't like the cameras showing up in your town, you know, to take surveillance on every cotton picking thing, if you don't like the license plate readers that are being put in and installed all over America right now, if you don't like the smart grid stuff that's going on where they're starting to, you know, they want to control the energy in your house, if you don't like the way property rights are progressing because of all of this new green zoning techniques and stuff, if you don't like the international business or the international standard for building codes that's being implemented all over America, if you don't like these things and you don't put up the resistance to stop it, you're going to get what you deserve. And I just hate to say it that way, but Americans need to be slapped in the face. What are you waiting for Pete's sake? These people are winning all over us. They're just beating us to death.
Yep. And it's interesting because you look at the little pieces that are contributing. And as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, it's interesting out here in California anyway, and I think it's happening in a lot of other places as well, you see the prison overcrowding being handled by letting people out of prison. Out here, the voters were dopey enough to pass a measure that turned a bunch of felonies into misdemeanors, so those people all got kicked loose. So now we have, you know, a lot of crime. As the economy continues to not do well, despite reports to the contrary, we have more and more people choosing to be homeless. Some are homeless because of alcohol and drugs, obviously, but welfare's paying pretty good benefits. So you have all these people roaming the streets, which is causing business owners to clamor for more surveillance cameras.
Yes.
It goes right back around. So what a great way to get everybody to enslave themselves. We need those surveillance cameras. We've got to do it. Do we have another quick break, Bob, on that note, on that unhappy note? All right, we're going to come back with more from Patrick Wood on technocracy and related things. Hey, Pat, when we come back, give us a little overview on Obama's 2030 plan on how likely it is we're going to see much of it in the next year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's another little piece of the puzzle. Join us online.
That's a story.
WeThePeopleRadio.us. All the information is there for you.
Closer I get, you're wasting your time. The more you ignore me, the closer I get, you're wasting your time. I will be in the bar with my head.
When they brush each other passing in the hall, Sue would smile and say this place is pretty small. You know love grows best in little houses with few walls to separate, where you eat and sleep so close together
You can't help but communicate.
It's all about just getting people to love each other.
Except you're sleeping so close together, it's your neighbor, not your wife.
Classic. Ha. Take a perfectly nice song and we just denigrate it. It's what we do here. Because we have to. If we don't laugh about some of this, we're going to all run out there with little pitchforks and go berserk. So, Pat, what's the deal with this White House 2030 thing?
Well, that was actually a United Nations initiative.
Of course it
was. Agenda 2030. And the idea is to completely implement sustainable development by the year 2030. And they created this document for everybody to sign along the way. The document was kind of put together more or less privately, I believe, over the last several years. But it was all put together and kind of signed, sealed, and delivered and given to them as a package. There was no debate at this last meeting at all. It's just like, here it is. Yeah, take it or leave it, and you better take it. So they all signed on to it, including President Obama. Congress is not involved in this whatsoever. This is considered to be still a quote-unquote voluntary operation. It's not, however, because while they talk about voluntary nature of it on one hand, they talk about the absolute necessity and requirement for doing it. And just coincidentally, we had the conclusion of negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is going to the president's desk probably as we speak. And once he announces that to Congress that he intends to sign it, Congress has 90 days to pass it on an up or down vote. No amendments allowed, very little public discussion allowed. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership puts teeth and everything that the Agenda 2030 Agenda has laid out. And it is everything that Agenda 21 was, plus a few more things. But it's essentially the same thing, just a greater sense of urgency now to get it done by the year 2030. And so the president has signed on to it. And I might add that the president's climate change policy, which he is enacting right now as well, was a product of strategy by John Podesta.
Him again.
Who was his? Yeah, you know John Podesta, mm-hmm. I'm sure. He's a snake in the grass. Also a member of the Trilateral Commission. Excuse me very much.
Of course he is.
What's the chances?
Uh-huh. The New York Times said last November that it was Podesta who single-handedly architected the president's climate change agenda and strategy. So that tells you that Obama doesn't know squat. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's an empty suit. He's being fed by these people. Here's your script, dude. Start reading it on the teleprompter. That's it. So Podesta was the guy that crafted this whole thing. And by the way, it was exactly the same thing that the United Nations is doing, because the day before Podesta went to work for Obama, he was part of the what was the name of that organization? He was part of the high-level panel of eminent persons on the post-2015 development agenda. How'd you like that on your business card? This is 27 people, including John Podesta, who was the strongman of the 27, who in July 2012 set about to create this 2030 agenda document that the UN just signed en masse on the 25th of September this year. This is where that document came from, the post-2015 development agenda. And Podesta was the guy that probably drove most of the conversation and most of the requirements for this post-2015 agenda. And he was the very guy that came back to Obama and gave him his complete, climate change for dummies.
Sure.
Policy. His quick course. Do this. And you know what's ironic about this? Podesta and his 27 eminent persons on their high-level panel.
Sure.
That's the high-level panel of eminent persons. These people are so over the top when it comes to ego. I mean, you must have to take a test for narcissism even to get close to these panels. I don't know. It's incredible. But
there's a Geiger counter that goes off.
Yeah, that's true.
The litmus test for the high-level panel of eminent persons is you have to be a narcissist. Internally, the United Nations refers to the 2030 agenda that just got signed on the 25th of September. They refer to it internally as, quote-unquote, the people's agenda. The people's agenda. As if everybody had a piece of it.
Yeah.
All the stakeholders were this, that, and there, you know, whatever.
Everybody they speak for everybody.
This is the people's agenda. And I look back through the chain of events here and found out that 27 people, probably driven mostly by John Podesta, a member of the Trilateral Commission, were the ones that came up with this stupid thing, had nothing to do with the people whatsoever. It's totally narrow agenda. Picked out of thin air by these people who want to control the world. And again, I say it's back to the Trilateral Commission. They were the ones originally that said, we will foster a new international economic order. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're everywhere you turn around, you see these people again. So that's Obama. That's Obama right now. All he's doing is he's just parroting the party line exactly what the UN said to do. He's doing it because John Podesta gave it to him to do. Wow. And now John Podesta, by the way, is campaign manager for Hillary Clinton. Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah. Obama 2.0.
Yeah, but,
actually 3.0.
But was he smart enough not to email her?
Let me give you a tip. This is just a speculative tip on the election for next year.
Okay.
Yeah. Hillary's on the ropes. Everybody knows that right now. It'd be a miracle if she lasts much longer. But John Podesta, being a member of the Trilateral Commission, is keeping the Clinton campaign machine alive because they've spent over 30 years building this machinery. They're not going to walk away from it and say, hey, it's been nice knowing you guys, game's over. You know, no more Clintons, no more whatever. But Podesta's hanging in there, and he's the kind of guy that doesn't pick the losing side.
He better be a good salesman.
Watch for Al Gore to appear.
Oh, dear God. Bob just threw up right there on the floor.
You think Biden's bad?
Who says we only have 30 seconds left?
Clean up.
Oh, my God.
Clean up aisle one.
Clean up on aisle one is right. Oh, my God. Yeah, it should be aisle two. Hillary's on aisle one.
That's true. Patrick, thank you very much. We're out of time. We got to do this again. We
need to talk just about the Trilateral Commission. We should have to do a whole show just about that.
We could
do that twice, probably. All right.
We'll do it.
We will do it. Thank you very much for joining us. And for everybody out there who only caught part of this and is going, what are they saying? WeThePeopleRadio.us. You can get in the know. See you next week.